And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello, hoodoo voodoo dudes and dudettes. It's the old Chris Keeper here. It was getting pretty cold in Chris Keeper country, so I've decided to take a couple weeks of rest and relaxation here at my favorite resort, Uncharted Zombie Island. Oh, it's beautiful and sunny. The service is slow, but all I need is this bag of brains here. Oh, you should do like I'm doing. Kick back, relax, take a load off, and watch this beautiful Fulky. I'll call it a masterpiece. They can't sue me. Masterpiece. Zombie 2, Zombie Flesh Eater, I don't know.
Ciao, Limi Amici, and welcome back once again to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. As always, I am one of your co-hosts, Mr. Luke Giaconetti, and I am joined, as always, by the ever-present and ever-lovable familiar band of freaks. First up, my good friend, Mr. Sean Engel.
Cappuccino, everyone.
And, of course, also good friend, the hair metal hero.
Cannelloni.
And, of course, the guy who we have to have on because otherwise, because of the contracts, we can't have a show without one of the freaks on it, Mr. Chris Honeywell.
Manja! Oh, yeah. There's some manja going on in this movie.
My gosh. Oh, my goodness gracious. This, if you didn't know from the show notes, the film we're looking at today is Zombie, also known as Zombie 2, also known as Zombie Flesh Eaters, also known as titles that I'm not going to get into them, as this is a podcast limited by certain time constraints. This is the first film that we're watching from Italian director Lucio Fulci as we continue our blood-soaked path through a little primer of Italian horror. A little background before we get started on Mr. Fulci. Fulci was born in 1927 in Rome, grew up, studied medicine in college, and then became an art critic. Actually, Fulci's obsession with destroying eyeballs, he said, is just directly related to his time as an art critic, because he said that he didn't like that you could look at something and see whether it had value or not, so that's why he liked destroying eyeballs. Came a screenwriter and then a director. And believe it or not, in the 1960s, Fulci was known as a comedy director, directing 18 comedies in Italy, most of which were never released outside of the country, but he was a very successful comedy director. And it wasn't until the late 60s, early 70s that he moved into genre work. First, he did a couple of gialli, including Lizard in a Woman's Skin and The Psychic and Don't Torture a Duckling, but also some really violent and almost barbaric spaghetti westerns, the most well-known being Four of the Apocalypse, but also films like Massacre Time. This is what really got him on the map commercially, were these very popular genre films. Horror and spaghetti western, along with peplum, were the big genres in Italy at the time. And this is what transitioned him into where we are today. It wasn't until 1979, after the release of Dawn of the Dead in Italy under the title of Zombie, Z-O-M-B-I, that Fulci made this film, Zombie 2, Z-O-M-B-I 2, known in the West as Zombie, Z-O-M-B-I-E, which was passed off as a sequel to Dawn of the Dead, and that is what first gained him international notoriety, and frankly, I say it's well-earned.
Definitely by confusing everyone about which movie came from which. Because, yeah, when you initially told us about that, I was like, okay, this isn't a sequel to Dawn of the Dead, but people said it was. So it's named Zombie, but it's actually named Zombie 2, but yes. It's spelled differently. Yeah, it was confusing. But, yeah, this is a barrel of fun movie.
Oh, yeah.
A barrel lined with nails.
That's true.
In the interest of completeness, I should say, because, you know, a lot of times on this show we've talked about how sometimes story is only kind of there as a framework to hang your set pieces.
Yes.
And except possibly for Twitch of the Death Nerve, which for all intents and purposes was almost an experimental film.
Right.
He seems to say to do that. Essentially, we have a yacht, an abandoned yacht, show up in New York Harbor, and a reporter finds it along with the daughter of the woman of the excuse me daughter of the man who owned the yacht. They go to the Caribbean, hook up with another couple, end up on an island called Matul, and then all hell breaks loose. That is your plot. Thank you. Good night.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's something about a father and a daughter, and daughter's looking for a father, whatever.
The thing that it made me realize that this film was going to be incredible was the opening scene was a person wrapped in a body bag and like a burlap sack all tied up, rising up and getting its head blown off. When that's the first shot in your film, you know something incredible is going to be coming.
Yep. And in true fashion for the Italian and other European horror genre horror output of the time, we go directly from that cold open to some very basic titles, but with an extremely haunting leitmotif-based theme, played entirely on synthesizer by Fabio Frizzi, was the composer for this. And the zombie theme, I mean, it comes up over and over again in the movie because it's really damn good and really damn creepy.
Yes, mm-hmm. It's like your prototype awesome electronic Italian score.
I would agree.
I love it. I love it as much as... It's not as... There's not as much going on as, say, a Goblin soundtrack, but I like the simplicity of it. The only part of it, the soundtrack that I didn't really think flew, was the worst reggae ever when they were on the boat. Yeah. And that was the only music that didn't really do it for me. But,
That whole sequence they're in St. Thomas doesn't make really a lot of sense when you think about it, because the guy that their cabbie has a Spanish accent. Or it's like in St. Thomas? That doesn't make a lot
why
of sense.
Why not? Hell, why not?
For an Italian, yeah, it's all Spanish down there. Sure. Why not?
Yeah. You know, you take a cruise, you take a Caribbean cruise, you know, you go to Jamaica, you go to St. Thomas, you go to the Cayman or whatever. Yeah, you're going to get a variety of different languages. But yeah, it did seem a bit out of place. A lot of the dialogue seemed out of place for this. I mean, despite the fact that the movie was a heck of a lot of fun, this was perhaps some of the worst character acting, or at least the worst American dialogue in this film. At least for me, I thought the characters were really just sometimes idiotic.
Paper thin, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Wafer thin.
Just one wafer thin mint.
I mean, these are your stereotypical voodoo zombies that they're dealing with. They're incredibly slow, yet these people can't seem to even... Yeah, and they're shufflingly slow. I mean, you know.
Well, when they get close, they sort of do a lot of. They'll do a little pounce on you, it seems like.
Yeah.
But I think you gotta let them get close first.
I mean, you could have a grandma with a walker get away from these zombies. That's that.
Kickstarter.
Okay.
Grandma with a walker.
Grannies versus zombies.
Oh, wow.
Wow, that's a Kickstarter. I would put $10 into that Kickstarter. But, you know, here's the thing that's weird about it. Usually there's some subtext, and with this it could have been like, okay, are the voodoo people, you know, driving the white men out? If so, what are the white men doing wrong on that island? They certainly had beefs with the conquistadors, but they're 400 years dead. so you have they have it both ways. You have your medical zombies, that are it's some sort of disease or something that's, passed on by biting.
Right.
And then you've got your voodoo zombies, which are conquistadors coming up out of their graves and coming up without anybody biting them or anything, just, crawling up out of their graves. So, and there's no real subtext because, at first you see the doctor and his wife arguing and she's, yelling at him about his experiments. So you're thinking maybe this guy's tinkering with stuff or something, but then you find out, no, he's really just trying to get to the bottom of it, like any doctor would. I don't see what was his wife's problem was. She was just psychotic or something.
She seemed a little off kilter. Mm-hmm. She liked the booze, I think. I saw her have a couple of mommy's little helpers every once in a while.
Yeah.
I think, Chris, you kind of hit the nail on the head. The Fulci wants it both ways here. But in a lot of ways, that's what Romero did. Because Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, we never get a definitive explanation for the origin of the zombies. So to me, what I've always looked at was Zombie 2. And again, it's when you get into these films, especially in the 80s, the titles are essentially meaningless. Because every distributor that would pick it up for another country would give it another title. And trying to figure out what the relationship between them all, you'll drive yourself batty doing. So here, I've always pictured Zombie as the prequel to Dawn of the Dead. Because the bad juju starts going on down in Matul. And then the boat, Anne's father's boat comes up and has a zombie in it. That gives one zombie in New York. And then at the end, spoilers, the Brooklyn Bridge is overrun with zombies walking around in Manhattan, and that's what leads to them, the epidemic. Of course, you can tell that Fulci was a master of getting just enough location shots in.
Oh, yeah.
There's just traffic going by underneath the zombies under the bridge.
Yeah, it was like...
But he dubbed in the sound of cars, like, driving away real fast, like panic style, so... He did a good job. He didn't have to pay native extras. You just hear their drums from the woods,
That was amazing.
Had to spend all that money on the shark sequence.
I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that in a really positive way. He filmed this in another film he did called Night of the Ripper. The New York Ripper, which is just a vicious slasher movie, where he'd film just enough. He'd basically go on vacation in New York for a week and bring a camera with him and film locations and then cut around it. And, it ain't filming in Manhattan for Superman the Mooney movie.
Right. You're not shutting down the street.
But it's effective for a cheap Italian movie, and I like that. So
that being said, it looks really good.
Well, that's the thing about Italians, man. They don't spend any money on scripts and actors. But they get a good cinematographer. This was filmed like an art movie, the cinematography was gorgeous and crisp and clean and done.
All those push zooms and everything.
Yeah.
That was really striking.
It was
well that too, and the shot of the sailboat coming into Newark Harbor, and you can see the panorama of the city. It's just the one thing these movies do have is some great cinematography. I agree with you there. The plot may be rail thin, and the acting may be somewhat subpar, but at least it's a joy to look at.
Yeah, and then if you soak it all in blood, then it doesn't even matter. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's the interesting thing I've always thought about Fulci is that Fulci died in 1996, and I don't think he ever really got his due during his lifetime. I think he's kind of come into being more in favor as we got into the DVD era, because a lot of his films finally got widespread recognition in the West once they were released. I say the West, I mean in North America, once they were released on DVD. A lot of these films were video nasties. Zombie was banned for at least, I think, 20 years by the British Film Board. And it didn't even have nunchucks in it. So I think now he's kind of, at the time he was looked at just a gore hound, an exploitation director, whereas now he starts, the artistry of his work starts getting a little more recognition. There's a couple, I mean, I love all the just very atmospheric shots we get of Matul, whether there's zombies shuffling about or not. There's one shot where we get, it's just a long, just a straight.
With the crab?
With the little crab walking. I love that.
Yeah, that struck me. I was just like, that's just really bleak, man.
Oh yeah, I love all the with the goats just wandering around and the way that, I mean, now the thing about the goats is, I mean, I've spent some time in the Caribbean. My wife and I we honeymooned in Jamaica. We've gone on several cruises, and you drive around in the Caribbean, you'll just see just goats walking around, you know, and little, you know, villages like this that, you know, they might have a church and then a few shanty buildings. That's commonplace. And so seeing that, and then you got cut inside the church, and it's now this hospital that is just filthy and moldering and disgusting. And, you know, Maynard, I feel a little bit for Dr. Maynard that he's trying to fight this, and he knows it's a losing battle.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of time, you know?
He's just following his Hippocratic oath to the fullest, but, yeah.
So visually, this movie always struck me. And then, you know, and again, Sean's absolutely right. Acting, you know, not this film's strong suit. You're going to see that as we go forward. But
the first thing I saw was Tessa Farrow, which... You know, I mean, Tessa Farrow's biggest claim to fame is, I would say, is they wrote, she was the subject of, and this, you're going to love this, Luke, of the Beatles song, Dear Prudence.
Oh, yeah.
She was having a LSD meltdown at the Maharishi's when the Beatles were there. And so they were they nicknamed her Prudence, and they were singing that song to get her to come out of a teepee because she was in the teepee hiding.
Oh boy!
So what character did she play?
She was the blonde.
Okay.
She was the not as naked one.
Okay.
Well, yeah, that's just funny.
The naked one, the dark haired girl. Oh boy! Oh boy!
Oh, which one? The wife or the one on the boat?
The one on the boat with
the
diver.
Yeah.
With the thong along. That was a butt that a thong was made for. That was just Italian. You could tell he was just like, I have to put your ass in this movie. Somehow.
Baby, your ass was a chiseled out of a marble.
Perfect, yes. So I'm putting it in the movie as much as possible. I mean, the scene with her in the thong, it's so obvious that it's like, okay, turn around now and get the... I mean, it was ostensibly done to get the reaction shot from, you know, the reporter from New York.
Well, but
was speaking for all of us.
Well, Peter and Anne.
Leading for all of us, I should say.
Peter and Anne are both staring at Susan while she's putting on her diving gear. Brian, played by Lucci regular Al Cliver, who I've always thought looks a little bit like Michael Gross, He's eating his cereal. He doesn't even freaking notice.
He sees that every day.
Yeah.
That's his girlfriend, you know, whatever. And, you know, it's that European. That's European nudity right there. She's totally unselfconscious and just like, what? Tits. Whatever. In the water, you know.
That pales in comparison to the, I'm going to show a woman taking a shower with three mirrors around her so you see everything.
Yes, of course.
The nudity in this is just completely...
It's
totally extraneous.
It's an Italian movie. Hey, come on.
But you know what? But you know, we go from...
I was saying, go thank God for those. I was like, ooh, mirrors.
I always love that. Now Fulci would do that and say, "Hey, look at this! I can shoot a scene with three mirrors, and you still can't see my camera."
Look how that was impressive.
But you know, we go from, you know, Maynard's wife in the shower with all the mirrors, and then the back wall is mirrors as well, which I thought was neat. But we go directly from that to her being stalked, and then the splinter in the eye.
Oh God!
From we go. We're in geek show heaven when it comes to that. We go from nudity to over-the-top graphic violence.
Mm.
And And the first
that was the scene I heard about before I saw this movie. I remember when I was a kid and this movie came out, and I think it was Siskel and Ebert, although I don't know why they would be talking about zombie, because it's really not in their wheelhouse of even bad movies that they would cover. But I remember them, somebody talking and just, you know, and, you know, and instead of just having gore or whatever, it's a slow, and you see the, yes, you do. And it's awesome.
That's the point.
It's literally.
And
you think we'd write this shit, folks.
I know.
The amazing thing is the first time you see it, especially if, I mean, well, you know what? I'm Italian. I got to tell you a story to make a point. I saw this movie in the summer of Jesus Christ. Must be 1990.
The summer of Jesus Christ.
Summer of Jesus Christ.
33 AD?
D. The two guys thrown. Yeah, we all know. The two Catholic guys know that. But anyway. So
wow.
It's like 1998 or so when this movie was released on VHS by Anchor Bay. I still I had my VHS for a long time. I think I finally gave it to one of my other friends. But we, you know, so we had been watching, as Anchor Bay was releasing Italian films, we were watching it. So we had watched like Phenomena and Deep Red and then Zombie. That was like the third one that we had saw. And so the first time you're watching this, first time I'm watching this, you know, she's barricading the door. The zombies break it down, reach in, grab her by the scalp, and they're pulling her towards the splinter. And in your mind, I'm thinking, no, they're not gonna do this. No, this is taking way too long. This is too long of a setup. They're never gonna do it. No, it's gonna stop right here. It's gonna cut. Nope, there it goes, right in her eye.
Yeah, very realistic. That's that's probably one of the best eyes going since Un Chien Andalou.
Oh boy,
yeah, oof.
I got that reference.
That's just and what's crazy is that in his next horror film, Fulci would do a scene that's similar and takes even longer.
So. See, I think that's the creepiest thing about it—the fact that it takes so long. If it was just a quick penetrating stab.
Yeah.
You know, like an American horror movie, someone getting jabbed in the eye or someone getting like a spear gun to the eye, you know, that would be, you know, it wouldn't have as much resonance.
Right.
But this, the slow build to it just makes it all the more
ruthless.
Yeah. And jarring and just and especially for me, because I have a phobia about eyeballs. Yeah. When I was a kid, my grandfather on my dad's side was a farmer, and he took me out to the farm one night when he had to work on this calf who had some sort of problem with him in his eye. So I had to sit there and watch as they held this calf down in one of the stalls and surgically removed its eye. So for my entire life, I have just been, I can't even put in contacts. I can't touch, you know, eyes. It's just, so this was really unnerving to me. Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the eye gouging is a fear of a lot of people because everybody's been taking a poke to the eye at least once.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's bad enough.
It's funny because the comic, I mean, that was one of the original things in the comic code. And like you'll still see in the Overstreet guide on the old crime covers that, you know, people will seek out the ones that have, you know, I can't remember what the code word for, but there's a phrase for, you know, an eye in peril in a comic book. And this was the first time I've seen it fully exploited on fit, like, you know, where he was wrenching out every little bit of that terror of something going in your eye. There's a terror of getting something stuck in your eye, but this was a slow, you see it coming, you know, torturous scene. And that's what makes it. Yeah, I think that and the shark are the two, like, just most brilliant set pieces I've seen in these Italian movies yet. Well, they stand out as, because they're not really brilliant. They're not like Argento where, you know, it's a Hitchcockian thing that happens. It's just brutal craziness.
Right. It's what you come. This is actually much more typical of Italian horror from the era than Argento is. Argento is almost the exception to it.
Right. He's like the, I always, I always looked at him as sort of like the gold standard. You know, he's sort of reached the highest level in that genre of everybody, you know, as far as artistry goes on the screen. But I gotta say, Zombie is every bit, it may have been more entertaining than Argento's movies, which I found very entertaining.
You don't need to think in this movie.
No.
No.
That's what I like about this next set of horror shows is I got to turn off my brain for two movies right in a row.
The splinter in the eye scene, like you said, Chris, you had heard of that before you'd even seen the movie. Mm-hmm. It's so iconic, Fright Rags has a T-shirt of it. It's my mother, which is the amazing part. And I he got me the shark versus zombie shirt, which they also did. But let's just segue right into that. You know, it's often the joke I've heard with this is Dawn of the Dead and Jaws were going to have a fight to see who got more Italian ripoffs made of them. And they filmed.
And this is another scene I heard I heard about before I saw it, that, you know, its reputation preceded it. And it was always the eyeball scene was described as being just unreasonably gross. And this one was described as being so completely cheesy and stupid that it was laughable. I thought it was very well done.
Yeah.
It's high concept for sure, but I thought the shark looked very realistic, albeit slow moving.
Well, they were underwater.
I was trying to figure out if they made a rubber shark or if they just had a real shark that was dead and they were pushing it around. But it seemed to be swimming and stuff.
Most of the time, that's a real shark. And the zombie is actually the shark's trainer.
Oh, so that's why he could wrestle around with it and stuff. Okay.
And originally Fulci had gotten a stuntman who was going to do it, and he begged off and said, "No, I don't want a shark to."
Smart guy.
Well, they did a very good job of keeping air to the trainer without having air coming out of his nose and mouth all the time, you know, or from a hidden. You don't see the air bubbles from a hidden scuba tank or anything. I thought it was very well done.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It looked like they were. It looked like they were, you know, giving him air because the shots weren't taking more than 30 seconds. So they're probably, you know, having people come in and give him air during the shots.
Oh yeah, but.
It looked like he was down there, you know, not breathing at all. So that was really good.
Well, you know, and that's something again. Getting back to the idea of zombies coming from voodoo, and I think it's interesting also that. In, you know, here in North America, especially those of us on the East Coast, voodoo is something that you've heard of growing up. You know, there are neighborhoods in parts of Charleston where it's ganja. They still speak the language that the islanders spoke mm-hmm. during the slave trade. There are neighborhoods that, you know, that you can go see a hoodoo priestess and get a hex taken off of you and such. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. voodoo is something that I think in America we're very familiar with. In Europe, voodoo that's crazy bad juju stuff that you don't know about, you know. That was stuff that went on that people would tell you about when they came back from you know, making a spice run or something. So voodoo is something way out there. And voodoo, of course, uses a lot of the iconography of Christianity because of the Christian settlers that came in. Right. I mean, even says that. He said it's a mix of
Catholicism and the old African religions.
And, you know, so that is something I think that was put to good use in these European films, because that is like, I'm trying to think of equivalent. That's almost, you know, like the way almost we think of certain like Eastern religions that we just don't have a lot of exposure to, you know. But yeah, I just to do the zombie versus shark, what it does, I think it takes real strong advantage of the fact that these are corpses that were reanimated by juju. Not by science. So there's no reason for him not to be that maybe he was somebody who drowned and the voodoo spell managed to reach him. He doesn't have to breathe. There's no reason why he can't be active underwater. It's one of those things like, yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
Well, in the last few Romero movies, there's been a because if you think about it, they don't have to breathe. Plenty of food underwater. Why not?
Well, that was part of World War Z, too, wasn't it? The book?
That was a big part of the book. There was a scene in there where there was, I think, a submarine that was trolling around the bottom of the ocean, and they actually heard zombies scraping on the hull of the submarine trying to get in. This is my just sort of vague recollection from listening to the book on tape, but yeah. And it also makes credence to it being voodoo and being magical, the zombies doing that, because you would think if it was a biological or a viral thing that were doing this, they'd still be affected by natural laws. They'd still be affected by decomposition and bloating and stuff, and that would, and sharks actually going after them and eating them. So the fact that he's down there and is not decomposing makes you have a kind of feel that these zombies are more mystical than they are biological.
Yeah. And the conquistadores are the, support that as well.
They were very well preserved for being 400 years old in a Caribbean, set underground in the Caribbean. Waste. Maybe if they're in the desert somewhere, they could have been desiccated out or something. But yeah, and
That to me has always been my favorite image, and I have the T-shirt to prove it. And it's the cover of the DVD, and it's the poster that we've all seen. It's just the face of the conquistadore, and it says the classic tagline of "We are going to eat you."
It's
on the box. That's what that is.
Yeah. I really liked when they all came out. I was like, that was some of the best rising. I mean, I realize it was shallow, but the way they got those actors to move was really creepy. It was so incredibly slow and just measured everything about it. They didn't twitch or anything.
Yeah.
It was just straight up through the dirt. And there was one guy that looked like he was being lifted. There must have been something pushing him up from underneath. It was really impressive.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's what does it for this film, is the sort of slow, plodding, pace of it, that it's not – it's not the 28 days later fast zombies, I think. It's that slow feeling of dread that really gets you with this.
Yeah, it's all atmosphere. And
And daylight atmosphere.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And then the transition to darkness. Now it's not like in, a more modernist zombie movie where it's darkness, but we're in a city or we're enclosed. Here, you're in the jungle, essentially. And, I agree with you. It's laughable that they're trying to run away from these incredibly slow, shambles. But after Peter has hurt his leg and they're trying to all kind of run half limp to the hospital, and it's so much better on the DVD than it ever was in the VHS. And you can see all the kind of pale forms of the zombies right on their tail. Even though they're moving really slowly, the humans can't move real fast either. And it's like, where are you going to go? You're on an island. You're on an island that's not on a map in the middle of the Caribbean. Where the hell are you going to go?
Mm-hmm.
And you're, oh, that's right. The shark broke your boat. is there. I remember having an argument with somebody. It's like, oh, that's stupid. There's no reason for that shark to be there. I said, that is a lie. I said, that shark is there to break the boat.
Uh-huh.
I said, oh, shark is there to break the boat.
Makes perfect sense to me.
To break the boat? Like, yeah, I'm gone.
That's what sharks do in these movies.
Yeah, the shark has seen Jaws. I mean, everybody saw Jaws by 79. Jeez. I will say this. There's two effects in this. One of them is subtle. One of them is the exact opposite of subtle that we haven't talked about that I really like. The subtle one is during the siege of the hospital, which is just, oh my God, that's like, remember way back when we watched The Thing from Another World? That was all that made me think of, is when they lay the trap for the thing and it just keeps coming at them. But when Brian takes the shotgun and shoots the conquistadores' head off and it's just dust.
Boom.
Yeah.
Oh,
that
yes.
Me out. It's like, oh man, there's nothing there.
Now I wish I could remember the exact quote, but there's a quote in here that I think they directly tried to rip off Dawn of the Dead. It was something like, when the earth spits up the dead, then they'll feast on the living, or something like that. It was basically a variation on the, when there's no room in hell, the dead will walk the earth.
The line that I always like is what Maynard says when he's riding in the Jeep with the four travelers. And Brian says, "You can't believe in voodoo, that's superstitious bullshit." And Maynard says, "Well, whatever it is, it makes the dead stand up and walk." Very few lines delivered with a lot of...
What do you say to that?
True.
There's not much to say to that.
But then the non-subtle effect that I really, really love is when the foursome go to the Maynard bungalow and find what I call the wife buffet.
Oh, and yes.
Where zombies have her laid out and are just ripping her apart. And it's all still very slow. They're just slowly ripping out entrails and eating. And I remember back in school at Clemson, I was screening this for a bunch of my friends, and one of my friends, we'll call him Rusty, and that's a long joke, but that's neither here nor there. He had when we watched Dawn of the Dead, he had missed the first 5 minutes and then spent half an hour asking questions about those 5 minutes. And so I finally just said, "Look, man, just shut up. Okay, just shut up and watch the movie." But when we watched Zombie, he was like, "Well, when we watched Zombie, I want to be there. It's like, okay. And I gave my normal spiel. I said, there's some gore in this movie. There's some real violent stuff, but it's real good. It's worth watching." And he was, Mr. Macho, gung-ho. "Oh, yeah, you can't show me anything. It's gonna turn my stomach, right?" He's cheering and hooting and hollering with us, and the splinter and the zombie shark and all that. When they get to the wife buffet, you could see him turn a little green around the gills. That's what I like about that, because this is not a showy, flashy scene. This is not one that's in the trailer like the other big gore effects. But damn, if that's not creepy as hell.
Well, yeah. You mentioned at the beginning that Fulci had a background in medicine or in...
Yes.
So I've got to say, watching that scene, the anatomy looked really good. I mean, it even looked a lot better than what we see in modern shows, yeah, like The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
The entrails looked, they had that sort of sheen to them.
Yeah.
That, because I've done some dissection, and unfortunately when you do dissection, they're all, they've got formaldehyde run through them and all this. You do like fetal pigs or cats or, whatever sort of stuff you're doing for a biology, but it looks that way, and they captured that really well. And I'll admit, watching that, I was like, "Ah, they really took a person and hacked them up."
Here's another change in the Italian movies is the blood in this looked like real blood, more or less. It wasn't the red poster paint that you get a lot of times in these Italian movies.
Now, in a couple of the scenes, like near the beginning where the zombie bit the person in the neck,
yes,
that looked a bit more watery, like paint. But the rest of the time, it looked amazing.
Oh, yeah. The blood in this is great.
They lay on the maggots, too. So
The maggots and the worms. And the conquistadores, it's just oatmeal. It's an oatmeal applied to your face. But, man, if that doesn't look creepy as hell.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Sean, you're absolutely right about the blood. When the conquistador bites Susan and rips out her throat, and then when she falls down and she is just absolutely covered in blood, as you would be if you were bitten there.
Mm-hmm.
God, that's just, it's like, oh man, it's you know, Argento, I think, got away with some of the violent stuff he did because he was so artistic about it. Fulci is always struck me as more of, you want gore?
Yeah, I'll hit you over the head with a stick of gore. Yeah.
Well, I think the delineation is that Fulci seems to be more realistic, while Argento seems to be more stylistic. He likes to have a certain sense of style to his movies and the violence, while Fulci, at least from this one movie that I've seen from him, is trying to get as much realism and as much natural feeling to what's going on in it as you possibly can.
I think Fulci in a lot of ways was more motivated by commercial interests than Argento. I'm not saying Fulci wasn't an artist, because I really think he was. I'm a huge fan. But,
well, as an art critic, you'd think he'd be aware of that. He just might have been like, "I don't want to be artsy, I want my message to be brutal and
I've read translated interviews with Vulture where he talks about that. He's like, you know what? It's like that's why, again, why he destroyed eyeballs was he didn't think that you could look at someone else's work and say whether it had merit or not. So he said, I'm going to make something that I want to make. There's a later film, in fact, one of his last films that Fulci made called A Cat in the Brain, which is known as Nightmare Concert in Italy. But A Cat in the Brain was its title in most of the world, where Fulci plays essentially himself. He plays the director of extremely gruesome horror movies with the conceit that, you know, producing and being involved in these films is going to drive someone crazy that they'll actually commit murder. And so basically the whole thing is a very metatextual response to how the critics responded to his films. That there's a great scene where, his special effects man brings him a tray. I think it's a tray of eyeballs, actually. And he goes, these are shit. Do this again. And he throws them all on the ground. So, yeah, I mean, that a lot of Italian filmmakers, non-genre and non-genre, came from film criticism. And then I think in the 60s and such, when Italian film really started to expand beyond what it had been before the war, that you get a lot of these guys that came from criticism and went into filmmaking. And a lot of them, you can tell, they just don't give a crap. They just don't care. They're going to make what they want to make, and criticism be damned. I mean, Fulci was an extremely successful director for most of his career. It wasn't until into the 90s that he started really, you know, that he was kind of hitting bottom of the barrel and not making money. So obviously he was making what he wanted to make, and he was doing pretty good doing it.
I'm sure this movie's made tons of money over the course of its life.
Oh, yeah.
Especially, it couldn't have had much of a budget, really, as far as that goes.
It definitely didn't go for acting talent, I'll say that again. One thing that I want to comment on is going back to acting talent and going back to how poor these characters were. You say the final scene where they're taking on the horde of zombies in the church. They're loading up on Molotov cocktails and throwing them way in front of the zombies. Rather than trying to hit them, they're throwing them way in front of them and catching the building on fire. The building that they're not going to be able to escape from. I was watching that and I was chortling to myself because
really, because a machete would have been your weapon.
Yeah, you go in there and you hack him in the head with the machete, and you hack the other one, and you make your way out. And these were slow-moving zombies. You know, these people were inept, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
You know, because when your quote-unquote pyrotechnic special effects probably was a bottle of kerosene with a
fire. Oh, God.
These guys in zombie makeup, they're working for scale, if that, right? You don't want to put buddy on fire.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess
some
so.
Fire stunts there. There were a few zombies.
Yeah, they did have one fire-walking zombie, yeah. But that guy probably took out, you know, three quarters of the budget.
Yeah, exactly.
I got to say, and just to, because this is Two True Freaks, I think at some point we are, contractually obligated to tie something back to Superman. I love that Brian is Daily Planet.
Yes, that's my fourth note.
The Daily Planet shirt, yes.
I have a buddy that's a dead ringer for Brian.
Really?
Blonde hair, huge beard, solid build. If I got him a Daily Planet t-shirt and took a picture, it'd be like, holy shit, it's him. I just like the guy who did his voiceover on the dub. Sounded like he was from Boston.
Conquistadores.
Well, except for that.
Yeah. Boston guy trying to sound like a Spanish accent.
Yeah. And that guy was Lily White.
Oh, yeah.
For a guy that spends all his time on a boat.
On a boat on the ocean in the Caribbean, yeah.
He still looked very Nordic.
Well, he was kind of red. He was kind of...
Yeah, like... when he took his shirt off, he looked like he had the top of it. He had his face and like the top of his chest tanned, or burnt, actually. But yeah, he was not a person who spent a lot of time in the sun.
It burns us.
The other thing I thought was neat, and I don't know this for a fact, but when we see Peter and Anne in the airport, was that, and again, is that the 1979 vintage Kennedy Airport?
Probably.
I know Kennedy doesn't look like that now, but god damn, that was a fabulous looking airport.
Yeah, well, that was space age as hell.
That was like the airport from 2001.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was it did look kind of out of place, but it was, yeah, very futuristic and very stylized as well.
I just, again, shoot just enough location work to, you know, convince us that we're there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got the feel from that. I remember watching that shot and I'm thinking, you know, I'll bet you a good amount of the people sitting around in here are really waiting for a plane. Which, yeah. I love stuff like that. That's really like sparks my imagination to think that there's people who are in this movie with all this nudity and gore and they didn't even know it, and they'd never know it, you know, or just like being an adult and seeing yourself as a little kid sitting in one of those chairs and going, what, wait, I was a zombie too?
And I think
the thrill of my life.
Yeah.
It was the same as when he shoots outside the office of the medical examiner. And there, and it's a little disappointing they didn't manage to catch like a real pimp mobile or something, but there's some real classic late 70s Detroit steel rolling down that road. I mean, some real giant stuff. You expect the chandeliers on the side, like Escape from New York. I love location work like that. That just, it's just a complete time capsule.
Time capsule, yeah.
Gosh,
my fifth note, which I had to scribble out, but it's funny because judging by the writing quality, because I remember at the watching the beginning and I'm like, and I watched this movie years ago, but I didn't really remember much except the shark and the eyeball and the gore. And I'm like, and I didn't remember it resolving in New York City. And then like halfway through the movie, I was writing like, wait a minute.
What happened?
Yeah, there was a zombie coming to life in New York City. And then I'm thinking, and I was thinking to myself, they're not even going to follow through on that. That's just going to be dropped. And then at the end, I was so happy that it was just like, okay, good. He didn't forget that.
And I do love the ending where they pick up the radio and the guy, I love anytime a radio announcer tells you about his own death.
They're coming in. The zombies are at the door. They're coming in. No.
Imperial troops have entered the base. Imperial troops have...
You know what it reminded me of, Chris? It reminded me of our molester bot spot. Which we all have to put that in.
That?
Because that's basically what you're doing. No, the molester bot is in the building. No.
It was that and Rockin' Ricky from Gremlins. That was...
Yeah, why is it that all the undead...
To tell you he was all right.
Yeah, it's always the undead and the gremlins and the evil minions that always decide to go after the radio shock jocks. Howard Stern better watch his ass.
I know.
You know, they, I'm not going to get it. But yes, it's like, you know, it's like there's nothing on. It's like, this guy's on for 6 hours. Come on. Play it still on. Play it. I'm killing him. I'm done. Oh my gosh. So yeah, this is just such a fun. This is definitely what I file under horror party movie.
Oh yeah.
It starts right at the beginning with zombies and somebody getting killed, and then there's a little bit of story. Then you get some nudity, and then you get a hellish zombie apocalypse in the Caribbean for 45 minutes. It's like, okay, win-win, you know. Yeah. I'm happy.
Exactly.
I think it's funny how we, oh no, Sean said it, but this movie does start with the bang.
Oh yeah,
literally. It's an off night for me, guys. I'm sorry.
Well, and I do like that scene is put into context.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Now they eventually come around to say, yeah, what it actually was. It was the doctor essentially taking out the person that he was working with, right?
Yeah, it's Fritz. It's his. Which I think is funny that if we're in the Caribbean. Okay, it's an Italian movie. We're in the Caribbean. With there's two white guys on the island. One of them is an older guy, maybe in his 60s, maybe late 50s, named Fritz. I think we know where this guy came from and why he's in the Caribbean, right?
I was not a member of the Nazi party ever. No.
I was never the minister of propaganda for the Pope.
Oh, that brain over there? That's a prop brain. That's not Hitler's brain.
Now, Tommy's eating Hitler's brain. That's a Kickstarter.
Ooh.
Oh, wow. Send all money care of Hair Metal Hero.
A zombie Hitler movie would be pretty spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, that's the last bad guy in the original Bionic Commando video game.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I just remembered there was actually a zombie movie with that. I haven't seen it yet, with a whole army of Nazi zombies.
What, oh, Dead yeah. Snow?
Dead
Iron
Snow.
Sky. No. Yeah, oh,
Iron
yeah,
Dead Sky
Snow.
Too, but there's Dead Snow.
Dead Snow is pretty good.
I have not seen it, but yeah, I heard that's Nazi zombies.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but yeah. So I did like that scene actually had some meaning, and so when it comes back around, the boat can leave now. Tell the crew. Not just that it's because it's kind of a ridiculous line. Doesn't really make any sense when he says it the first time until you say, okay, there's a boat. But why can the boat leave now?
It sounds for boat. I love it. It sounds for boat. It's way more. It hints at more than the movie's going to deliver, like, storytelling wise. But it's kind of nice, you know.
Yeah. Actually, I misspoke. That's not Fritz. That's Anne's dad.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Fritz kills Maynard. That's my mistake. We see him kill. Fritz is the first guy he has to kill. That he shoots, and he says, oh, he agonized over, and he finally shot him. But yeah, he kills Anne's father with that. So there's a little bit of story.
She's not too broken up over her dad's death. She's pretty clinical about it.
Well, I think there was more important shit going on, like trying to keep your throat intact.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. All right. So anyone got any last thoughts on Lucio Fulci's Zombie 2, other than just rattling off alternate titles for it and dragging it?
No, it was great. This was a fun zombie movie, and yeah, oh, the eyeball splinter scene. Ugh, that is at the top of some of the creepiest stuff that I have witnessed on film.
Yeah, it delivers a jelly in that scene for sure. I'm gonna have to go. I think this is the only Fulci movie I've ever seen, so I'm gonna have to definitely dig up more, because, so to speak.
Yeah, I'll get right to the point and say, go rent it.
Yeah.
Buy it on our Amazon.
Yes, please do.
There's actually two really good DVDs of this out there. I think one of them may be out of print. The Anchor Bay is the one I have, is titled Zombie, Zombie. It has a black cover with the Conquistadore on the cover. The other is by Media Blaster's horror outfit, which is called Shriek Show, and it's called Zombie 2, Zombie. And just an aside for that, I remember when I was in college, people would think I was trying to be cute by spelling zombie, Z-O-M-B-I. And I'd say, no, in Italian, there are certain words that end in I that are the same whether they are singular or plural. Zombie is one of them. You can say il zombie or I zombie, and it means either the zombie or the zombies. So zombie is, you can use that, and it means plural. That's why there's all the confusion. But yeah, that the Shriek Show one is real nice. Both have the film is not ever going to get super cleaned up. It's just the stock was so kind of rough on it. But both DVDs are real nice. I've seen both of them. So yeah, definitely go to Amazon.com through Two True Freaks and pick that up. And while you're there, you might want to pick up the next Fulci film that we're watching the next time we do an Italian film on the Vault of Starling Monster or Tales of Terror, which is a film from 1980 entitled The Beyond.
Beyond. I've heard of that.
Beyond.
That got pretty good American release, didn't it?
Yes. The Beyond was released back in the day as Seven Doorways to Death, and actually got some play in the U.S. and did get released on video. That was actually one of the films that kind of kickstarted, no pun intended, the whole resurrection, pun intended, of the Italian horror films in this country in the 90s, because it is a personal favorite of Quentin Tarantino. And Tarantino had a copy that he would show at theaters and screenings and such, and that's what got it its recognition. In fact, if you look at the new releases of The Beyond, it does credit Rolling Thunder Pictures, which is Tarantino's studio, as... They get a credit piece at the beginning.
Is he still digging out his favorite exploitation movies and release it? Because I remember he put out Mighty Peking Man.
I don't know that he's been doing that, but I remember...
It was a long time ago that I got Mighty Peking Man. I'm like, oh, I'm so glad that Tarantino's doing this, and I don't remember it ever, like...
Yeah, I don't think it really
went any further.
Said I remember Mighty Peking Man. I remember The Beyond. There was one other that I know for that I cannot remember what other one was. But yeah, you know, be that as it may, what it means is that we get movies like The Beyond on beautiful DVDs and Blu-rays here in the U.S. So come on back next time. We'll be taking a look at The Beyond. And until then, any final thoughts, guys?
Protect your necks.
Yeah, and tell them the boat's ready to sail.
Yeah.
Sailing.
Wear safety glasses.
Oh, yeah.
Sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today.
If you shop at Amazon.com, please consider using the link at TwoTrueFreaks.com to shop there. If you use this link to go to Amazon and then you shop, Two True Freaks gets a little cut of what you buy and it doesn't cost you anything extra. So you get to shop as usual and help out the Two True Freaks at the same time.
Welcome to Amazon. I love you.
Visit our brand new website at twotruefreaks.com.
Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook, too. My name is spelled Scott Gardner.
You can friend me on Facebook, too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
We were finally invited aboard one of these spacecraft, which landed near Ann Arbor, Michigan on October the 24th of 1954. This is a drawing of the craft. As I was leaving the craft, the commander, Soltek, said, "Soon others of your people will be able to have an experience similar to this."